From Pennsylvania to Oregon, Texas to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Federal Reserve has begun what is likely to be a series of interest rate hikes. Here to explain what the Federal Reserve is and why its decisions matter is Thomas Honick from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Confirmation hearings were held this past week for President Joe Biden's nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to be an Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. A change in how prevailing wages are calculated could add fuel to the inflation fire. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine finds out why from Daniel Bosch of the American Action Forum. And Vladimir Putin didn't invade any of his neighboring countries during the presidency of Donald Trump. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains why. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Federal Reserve has begun the process of implementing policies that will raise interest rates and is expected to implement a number of additional hikes in the months ahead. Here to examine the role of the Federal Reserve and to discuss the impact of the rate hikes is Thomas Honick. He is a distinguished fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Tom, welcome to American Radio Journal. Tom, the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve Board, folks hear about it, but a lot of times don't really understand what it is or what it does. So before we get into a discussion on what it is doing, tell us a bit about the Federal Reserve.
Well, the Federal Reserve is, for the United States, what is known as its central bank. So it is the body that literally creates money, the dollar, in the United States and conducts monetary policy as its principal function. In other words, it has accounts with every major bank in the United States. And when it buys government securities or other assets, it can create a deposit for those banks that become then the basis for money growth in the United States. So it's a bit esoteric, but it's basically how we create dollars in the United States for growth. And it's structured differently than most central banks because of the United States Federalist background. It is, yes, has a board of governors in Washington, D.C., but it has 12 regional Federal Reserve banks that also participate in the monetary policy mechanism from the region. So it brings information in from around the country into the policy discussions. Now, that's its principal goal, but the Federal Reserve system, the central bank, also is involved in the supervision of banks in the United States. And also, it is a primary and principal player and participant in the payment system. It's how banks settle payments, that is, settles accounts among banks. So as customers write a check on their account in one part of the country, it can move that account, that money, I should say, across the country without any real friction. So it's a major player in the U.S. economy in creating money and how it's, the economy is operated in the banking sector and how payments are conducted. And so in the kind of a nutshell, that's how I would describe this country's central bank.
And this central bank, Tom, has a role in trying to keep, among other things, inflation under control, and in as much as it also sets interest rates. Tell us a bit about where we have been in that process. And interest rates right now are pretty much at a historic low, are they not?
That is correct. So when I talk about the Federal Reserve creating money, it does so, and that affects interest rates. So as the Federal Reserve creates more dollars, puts them out, they become cheaper to get, so interest rates go down. And so that's what they've been doing since before the pandemic. They did that after the great financial crisis, and then they did it again just prior to the pandemic, and then they did it further during the pandemic. And so by printing literally trillions of dollars, creating trillions of dollars, they keep interest rates near zero, 25 basis points to 50 basis points at the moment. And that's how they keep interest rates very, very low. And therefore, that's why we hear all this discussion today about inflation. Because with all this money being created and the spending going on, inflation has risen to a 40-year high. And that is now troubling the Federal Reserve and this country. And that's why they're paying so much attention to it at the moment.
The fact that inflation is at a 40-year high here, Tom, of course, ultimate responsibility for that goes to Congress and the president for authorizing and engaging in all that spending. But as you mentioned, the Federal Reserve had to, in essence, print that money. Is this a core cause of the current inflationary cycle we are in?
Yes, it is. I think, number one, you're right. The Congress and the administration engaged in a fairly significant expansion of spending during the pandemic and actually before. So to give you an idea, the national debt prior to the pandemic, was between $24 and $25 trillion, and now it's above $30 trillion. So they spent that money and borrowed that money. Now, the Federal Reserve enabled them to do that and keep interest rates low because they bought a good deal of that debt, put it on its balance sheet. So, for example, the Federal Reserve's total balance sheet, shall we say, increased from about $4.5 trillion just prior to the pandemic, to $9 trillion today. So you can see the amount of money that was created in a very short period of time and spent in a very short period of time. And that has contributed mightily to the breakout of inflation to this 40-year high.
And now that we have this inflation rate that is really putting a pinch on a lot of Americans, particularly those in lower incomes, what can the Fed do and what are they planning to do going forward to try to put the genie back in the bottle?
Well, you're right. This inflation is what I call a very regressive tax. It reduces disposable income for individuals because you're paying more for the same amount of goods. So it's a very regressive tax, and therefore it needs to be addressed. Now, the Federal Reserve at this point has indicated that it is going to stop printing so much money. That was done as of March this month. It was the last month in which they were adding more to it. And they also indicated they were going to raise interest rates that would reflect that slowing in the creation of money. And by doing that, they hope to contain the excess spending that goes on in the economy. And I think, and therefore, over time, over the next year, they hope to bring inflation down. But that is quite a challenge, given the amount of money that is already in the economy circulating, to bring the inflation rate down from 8% towards 2%, which is their goal. It'll be possible to do, but it won't be painless, in my opinion. It does mean the economy will slow. And perhaps even have some increase in unemployment. There is speculation and concern that it could actually lead to a recession, which no one knows for certain. But that, of course, sometimes follows when you raise interest rates in the economy, in an economy of this size.
Raising interest rates, Tom, what impact does that have on the average citizen?
It can have a lot of impact. Number one, it makes borrowing more expensive. So as you've already seen, if you've been reading the newspaper, that the mortgage rates are going up. They're now above 4%. As we move forward, borrowing to buy a car will become more expensive. We will see that businesses will have to pay more to borrow to build additional capacity, if that's what they wanted to do. So it does tend to slow the economy because of the increasing cost of borrowing and investing in the economy.
We have been talking with Thomas Hodnik, who is a distinguished senior fellow, that, of course, at George Mason University. Tom, tell us a bit about the Mercatus Center and where can folks go online to read your writings? You've written on this and many other subjects.
Sure. Number one, the Mercatus Center is it's a research-based policy institution. It tries to bring market solutions to economic problems rather than, shall we say, top-down government solutions in each case. So it's more of a market-oriented institution. You can read about it or you can go to its webpage. It's mercatus.com.
Thomas Honig of the Mercatus Center. Tom, thank you for taking time to be with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
At the Club for Growth, we have Scott Parkinson standing by, and it's been a busy week on Capitol Hill. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman. Thank you.
We have before us the confirmation process underway for a replacement for Justice Stephen Breyer, Ketanji Brown Jackson. Those hearings took place this past week. We're going to talk about what occurred in those hearings, but Scott, tell us a little bit about the process for naming and confirming a justice to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Some of this has changed in recent years when we had the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Mitch McConnell did the nuclear option on Supreme Court nominations in the Senate so that a justice can be confirmed with a simple majority vote. Obviously, in a 50-50 Senate, that means that this justice would be confirmed by a tie-breaking vote from the president of the Senate if it were a 50-50 vote. Now, my prediction is that several Republicans will ultimately vote yes, so the vice president will not cast that deciding vote. But it is something to kind of keep in mind, the way that a nominee is confirmed out of committee, reported to the Senate floor, and then ultimately sworn into office after confirmation. So here's a judge that has gone through, I think basically a show hearing. Most of the questions have been political gotcha questions that the nominee typically avoids answering. And one great example of that is Senator Marsha Blackburn asked Judge Jackson to simply give the definition of what a woman is. And Judge Jackson is the first African-American female nominee to the Supreme Court. And the bottom line is she couldn't even give us a definition of what a woman is, because we know that the woke progressive left would possibly try to take down her nomination if she said there are only two biological genders. So that was sort of one little highlight of what we saw. But what we should expect next week is the Senate Judiciary Committee to report this nominee to the Senate floor. Then there will be an intervening week, and I would expect confirmation in the United States Senate for this nomination the week of April 4th.
Taking a look at this nomination, she would replace Justice Stephen Breyer, who is on, as we say, the left wing of the court. So does this nomination and likely ultimate confirmation really change anything on the Supreme Court?
It doesn't change the specific balance when you think about who the conservative justices are and who the liberal justices are. But Judge Jackson's record is extremely progressive. And that's one thing that you have to keep in mind. When the ideological balance of the court shifts a little bit, that can certainly shake out votes for future landmark cases that the court will be hearing. Another thing to keep in mind here is that Breyer is still on the court, and yet he announced his intention to leave the court after this Supreme Court session, which typically occurs at the end of June. But in theory, he could actually change his mind. And we know that the Democrats have been out there for several years entertaining this idea of stacking the Supreme Court. So if the United States Senate actually confirms a nomination to be Associate Justice on the Supreme Court without a vacancy, does that establish a new precedent where a president could make unlimited nominations and either stack the bench for people that would later fill any vacancies? Or is that a natural way to actually stack the Supreme Court? Because once you're confirmed by the United States Senate and you're sworn into office, what would actually stop a nominee that's been confirmed from taking a seat on the Supreme Court? Now, obviously, statute says that there are only 9 positions for a justice on the Supreme Court, 1 chief justice and 8 associate justices. But the bottom line is, with brand new precedent, how would another court determine whether or not this justice that's gone through the Senate confirmation process, been confirmed, is prohibited from actually getting a seat? So that's sort of like inside baseball here in Washington. but it's something that a lot of people are starting to think about. What is the precedent of this United States Senate in confirming a new justice to the court when the vacancy actually hasn't occurred yet?
Could be an interesting constitutional question at some point in the future. We have about a minute or so left here, Scott, so let's shift gears a little bit. We've been tracking key United States Senate races around the country. In Alabama, there is a very hot race for the Republican nomination. A major development this past week. Can you give us some details?
Yeah, this week in Alabama, President Trump sended his complete and total endorsement of United States Senate candidate Mo Brooks, who is currently a representative from, I think, the 5th Congressional District in Alabama. And he has announced that he intends to endorse another candidate in that race. We obviously are looking at a competitive race with Mike Durant and Katie Britt also vying for the Republican nomination. In Alabama, it is a runoff state, and I think that it is likely that this race will go to a runoff. But Mo Brooks is not dropping out of the race. And I know that we sometimes talk about the Club for Growth PAC and our endorsement of Mo Brooks remains. We have not rescinded that. We still think that he's the only conservative in this race. And so it becomes a question of, do we get an economic conservative like Mo Brooks who's going to fight back against the establishment and Mitch McConnell, or do we have somebody like Katie Britt or Mike Durant that ultimately becomes a rank-and-file vote for Mitch McConnell and his leadership in the United States Senate? So this is going to be a dogfight. We understand that. We've got a couple of months before the election, but it's one of the top elections in the primaries to be keeping a close eye on.
And we are keeping a close eye on these races with a 50-50 evenly divided U.S. Senate. We are doing that with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. So the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., and we're united in this idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. If anybody listening wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up to become a member for free. Join over 525,000 other Americans that have already done that.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
And now we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine, who talks with Daniel Bosch of the American Action Forum about a proposed change in prevailing wage rules that will further add to inflation.
Back in the 1980s, the Reagan administration made some changes to some labor regulations that are part of what's known as the Davis-Bacon Act, and they did that in part to help control inflation. Now the Biden administration, the Biden Labor Department, is planning to undo those changes at a time when we already have the highest inflation, well, since the early 1980s. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Dan Bosch. He's the Director of Regulatory Policy over at the American Action Forum, and he's got an excellent piece, an excellent analysis that you can find there, looking at this new policy sort of quietly announced last week by the Labor Department. And he's here to walk us through all the specifics. Dan, thanks for taking some time with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So this is a change to something known as, or a change to how something known as prevailing wage will be calculated. We should probably just start there. What is the prevailing wage, and why does it matter to like what the government pays for basically anything it does?
Sure. So prevailing wage is essentially for a certain type of work, let's say plumbing, for example, in a given geographic area. The wage rate that's paid to most of the people that do that work in that area. And so for the purposes of the Davis-Bacon Act, what Davis-Bacon requires is that for any federal government contract that results in construction work or infrastructure work, the workers who work on that contract have to be paid at that prevailing wage.
And as you note in your piece, again, folks can find this at AmericanActionForum.org. You note here that this is going to be the first major overhaul to these regulations in about 40 years. The Reagan administration changed the way prevailing wage was calculated, and they did it specifically in response to inflation, right?
Yeah, it was certainly a primary driver. They were concerned going through the 1970s. We experienced high rates of inflation. Certainly those continued into the 80s. And there was actually a pretty sustained effort within the government to look for opportunities to combat inflation. One of the results of that effort was a GAO report, a Government Accountability Office, that found that the DBA had inflationary effects, and they actually recommended its outright repeal, but Congress never actually went forward with that. So the Reagan administration did some changes to try to make some of those effects.
Just make that connection for us, because how is it that the way the government calculates wages can affect inflation? Like, because it sort of seems like the flow there would go the other direction, right? Like, if wages go up because of inflation, that would affect prevailing wage. But this is really sort of, there's a feedback loop effect here, maybe.
Yeah, well, essentially, so wages go up, so the cost of construction projects goes up. So those obviously have inflationary pressures on every other price that's connected to the project.
And so now the Biden administration is proposing to change the way this prevailing wage is calculated. They basically want to re-implement something called the 30% rule. Maybe you can explain it better than this, but that effectively looks at just the highest set of wages in a given area, right? And sets the government wage for contractors based on maybe not necessarily what the highest 30% are earning, but on a higher chunk than the overall average.
Right. So essentially what happens is that it looks at, if 30% of workers are paid the same rate, then that's considered to be the prevailing wage, unless that amount is actually 50%, in which case it technically is a prevailing wage. So what happens is that often, as a result of collective bargaining and unions, 30% of workers will receive a certain wage, and because it's collectively bargained, it tends to be higher than what maybe a non-union workforce would get. And so that's how just 30% of the workforce can actually raise the wage that their government pays for everybody.
Yeah, the labor unions love this stuff, and that's exactly why I would imagine the Biden administration is pursuing it. We're talking with Daniel Bosch. He's director of regulatory policy over at the American Action Forum, talking about this new policy that the Department of Labor has announced. They're going to begin the sort of long, slow bureaucratic process of implementing these changes to the way prevailing wage is calculated. And Dan, I guess we should finish up on this point, because in the documents that were published last week by the Department of Labor explaining this, they do sort of confront this question of how this change could affect inflation or how it could intersect with inflation. And they really downplay this. They say that, like, even if concerns about an inflationary effect on government contract costs are true, they just sort of poo-poo it and say, well, you know, it's not something we really need to worry about. The Biden administration has ignored people warning about inflation before. Is that what's happening again here? They're ignoring these warnings, and then it's going to come back to bite them again?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems like it's going to come back to bite them. I think the timing of this could not be worse from an inflationary perspective. And essentially what they're arguing is that they are not technically ignoring it. What they're saying is that their hands are tied, and that the purpose of the Davis-Bacon Act in its entirety is to pay construction workers more, even if it increased the cost to the federal government. So they're basically saying, legally, we can't really consider inflationary effects as part of this rule.
And of course, we've got a big infrastructure bill and a lot of infrastructure spending coming down the pike. Regardless of the inflation question, if you end up imposing higher costs on infrastructure projects, that means ultimately taxpayers get less for them, right?
Absolutely. And it's really simple math. You have to pay more for a certain project than the overall number of projects you can do with the $550 billion in new spending that was passed last November. The number simply drops and there are fewer projects that can be completed.
So we'll get less bang for our buck, and we'll also maybe make inflation a little bit worse in the process. Sounds like a great idea. Thanks for walking us through it, Dan.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And again, that is Daniel Bosch. He's director of regulatory policy at the American Action Forum. Check out his latest report, this analysis of the Department of Labor's proposal. You can find that at AmericanActionForum.org. They do lots of other fine work as well. You can click around on there. Check out our coverage of this and everything else going on in Washington, D.C. and around the country at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Vladimir Putin never took advantage of his supposed friendship with Donald Trump to invade neighboring countries. Why is that? Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Trump supporters are pounding their chests over what they believe is a rhetorical question. Why didn't Vladimir Putin do what he's doing in Ukraine when Donald Trump was president? Well, it's a fair question, one that fair-minded liberals ought to be asking. In fact, one of them, comedian Bill Maher, raised it. He said, quote, "If Putin thought Trump was really that supportive of him, why didn't he invade when Trump was in office? It's at least worth asking that question," unquote. It is indeed. The last time that Vladimir Putin took a bite out of Ukraine was in 2014, when Barack Obama was president and Joe Biden was vice president. He's at it again, but far worse. I never thought he'd actually invade Kiev. So, 2014 and 2022. It doesn't take a mathematical genius or Henry Kissinger to figure out that Vlad refrained from invasions during the Donald Trump presidency. And as someone who's hardly a Trump apologist, I think I have some credibility on this. In fact, I warned in 2015 and 2016 that electing Trump would be bad for NATO, bad for Poland, and good for Vladimir Putin. My conservative Polish friends, who adore Ronald Reagan, were very worried about Donald Trump's early statements about Poland and NATO. My warnings infuriated Trump supporters. A lot of them quit reading my columns. And yet, Putin largely behaved himself under Trump. Why? Well, we don't know all the reasons. Putin isn't exactly going to sit down on a couch and sob a pile of psychobabble to Oprah Winfrey emptying his heart. But generally speaking, and I say this as a student of international relations, perception matters in international relations. Everyone knows this. It's why even CNN liberals had a cow over Joe Biden's debacle in Afghanistan last July. Everyone knew that Biden's dismal failure not only sent a signal to the Taliban and ISIS, but to the likes of Putin and Xi in China. Going back to 2014, Putin plowed into the Crimea not long after Barack Obama's infamous open mic moment, telling Putin lapdog Dmitry Medvedev that he would have more flexibility after the election. A grinning Medvedev greedily replied, yes, I tell Vladimir. Well, he did, and Vlad listened. Putin, nurtured in the KGB, respects strength and preys on weakness. A president who understood this was Ronald Reagan. Said Reagan, quote, if you were going to approach the Russians with a dove of peace in one hand, you had to have a sword in the other. We had to bargain with them from strength, not weakness, unquote. Reagan had a favorite maxim toward the Russians, doveri, no proveri, trust but verify. And yet, that was not what Barack Obama did. Obama approached Vladimir Putin with a dove in one hand and a big bouquet of roses in the other. And Putin bit it off. He exploited it. He abused it. So, fast forward to the Trump years. Liberals portrayed Donald Trump as a belligerent nutcase, not to be trusted with his itchy finger near the nuclear button, even as Trump, as president, actually rarely used military power. In fact, Trump got along well with Crazy Kim in North Korea, albeit spouting some outrageous statements gushing about the little dictator, but still, he got along. And what Trump achieved in the Middle East, with multiple Arab nations recognizing Israel, was tremendous. It would have earned a Democrat president the Nobel Peace Prize. But liberals, instead, they framed Trump as a wild man. Well, that probably had an unintended positive effect of deterring someone like a Vladimir Putin. So whatever Putin's reasoning, it is undeniably striking that he didn't seek to annihilate Ukraine under President Donald Trump. For 4 years, he hit the pause button. Now, his troops are ripping it up. And that fact shouldn't be shrugged off by Trump haters. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KSOK-AM in Arkansas City, Kansas. Welcome to our new listeners. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.